The chief clerk will call the roll.
Baker.
Here.
Barlow.
Here.
Berger excused. Blake.
Here.
Blevins.
Here.
Blickrey.
Here.
Brown.
Here.
Burkhart.
Here.
Bird.
Here.
Campbell.
Here.
Kennedy.
Here.
Coleman. Coleman.
Here.
Connolly.
Here.
Davison.
Here.
Eklund.
Here.
Esquivel. Esquivel. Filer.
Here.
Freeman.
Here.
Gay.
Excused.
Gay excused. Gingery. Goggles.
Here.
Greer.
Here.
Green.
Here.
Halverson.
Here.
Harshman.
Here.
Harvey.
Here.
Hunt.
Here.
Hunt.
Here.
Hutchings.
Here.
Yagi.
Here.
Kasparik.
Here.
Kirkbride.
Here.
Croker.
Here.
Krohn.
Here.
Larson.
Here.
Lockhart.
Here.
Lauk.
Here.
Madden.
Here.
McKim.
Here.
Miller.
Here.
Moniz.
Here.
Nicholas.
Here.
Northrup.
Here.
Patton.
Here.
Paxton.
Here.
Petrov.
Here.
Piperinen.
Here.
Reeder.
Here.
Simlick.
Here.
Summers.
Here.
Stubson.
Here.
Teeters.
Here.
Throne.
Here.
Wallace.
Here.
Walters. Walters. Watt. Wilson. Wilson. Winters.
Here.
Zwanitzer Dan.
Here.
Zwanitzer Dave.
Here.
Mr. Speaker.
Here.
Esquivel. Walters.
Excused.
Walters excused. 57 present, 3 excused.
The prayer of the day will be offered by Reverend Bob Girard, representing the First Presbyterian Church in Cheyenne.
Like the hymnist Eleanor Fairgeon wrote in Praise to You, morning has broken like the first morning. And we do praise you for this new day. Yet the day may not feel that fresh and new to all of us as we begin the week of plodding through vital legislation. By your Spirit, please warm up the temperature outside, and inside, recreate your energy, intelligence, and love in each person here. Reawaken their attention to details, tune up their skills to listen, fill their mouths with wisdom as they speak, reaffirm their calling to serve you and the people of this state, and give them elation at what is accomplished. Thanks for hearing this prayer, Lord God, and warmly in your name we pray. Amen.
Thank you.
Representative Filer.
Mr. Speaker, could I have the privilege of the floor?
Please proceed.
Mr. Speaker, brothers and sisters of the 62nd Legislature, it's in my honor and privilege today to introduce our page of the day. This is my daughter, Vanessa Filer. She's a third grader at Goins Elementary School, Miss Tingle's class this year, and is well liked by all the staff and students at her school. She excels. Everybody really adores her. She works hard, and I like to let her know that her mom and I are very proud of her, and very happy that she could be here with all of us today. Thank you.
Vanessa, welcome to the House. We're now at that order of business of Journal Committee report.
Your Journal Committee reports that the Journal of January 11th, 2013 has been read and recommends that it be approved, signed by Representative Winters and Filer.
The doctor of the day today is Dr. Kenneth Madsen, MD from Cheyenne. Dr. Madsen, if you're around, welcome to the House. That order of business of introduction, reading, and reference of bills. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill number 22.
House Bill number 22 is introduced by Gingrey.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to crimes and offenses.
House Bill number 22 is referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 36.
House Bill number 36 as introduced by Representative Gingrey.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to offenses against property, renaming the crime of larceny and modifying elements of the crime.
House Bill number 36 is introduced to committee, is referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 39.
House Bill number 39, introduced by Representative Gingrey.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to crimes and offenses.
House Bill number 39 is referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 67.
House Bill number 67, introduced by Representative Gingrey.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to crimes and offenses.
House Bill number 67 is referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 75.
House Bill 75, introduced by Representative Dave Zwanzer.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to personal property liens.
House Bill number 75 is referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 76.
House Bill number 76, introduced by Representative Dave Zwanzer.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to criminal procedure.
House Bill number 76 is referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 139.
House Bill number 139, introduced by Representative Brown.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to Uniform Trust Code.
House Bill number 139 is referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 144.
House Bill number 144, introduced by Representative Connolly.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to kindergarten readiness.
House Bill number 144 is referred to Committee number 4, Education. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 134.
House Bill number 134, introduced by Representative Brown.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to highways.
House Bill number 134 is referred to Committee number 5, Agriculture. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 135.
House Bill 135, introduced by the Travel Committee.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to snowmobiles.
House Bill number 135 is referred to Committee number 6, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 136.
House Bill number 136, introduced by the Travel Committee.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to game and fish.
House Bill number 136 is referred to Committee number 6, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 143.
House Bill number 143, introduced by Dan Zwanitzer.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to game and fish.
House Bill number 143 is referred to Committee number 6, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 138.
House Bill number 138, introduced by Representative Lebnow.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to administration of the government.
House Bill number 138 is referred to Committee number 7, Corporations. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 142.
House Bill number 142, introduced by Representative Dave Zwanitzer.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to vehicle and watercraft titles.
House Bill number 142 is referred to Committee number 8, Transportation. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 147.
House Bill number 147, introduced by Representative Kasparyk.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to motor vehicle registration.
House Bill 147 is referred to Committee number 8, Transportation. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 148.
House Bill number 148, introduced by Representative Gingery.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to law enforcement.
House Bill number 148 is referred to Committee number 8, Transportation. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 140.
House Bill number 140, introduced by Representative Lebnow.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to environmental quality.
House Bill number 140 is referred to Committee number 9, Minerals. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 15.
House Bill number 15, introduced by Representative Gingery.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to mandatory reporting of violent injuries.
House Bill number 15 is referred to Committee number 10, Labor. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 145.
House Bill number 145, as introduced by Dan Zwanitzer.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to insurance.
House Bill number 145 is referred to Committee number 10, Labor. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 146.
House Bill number 146, introduced by Representative Wilson.
The first reading of the bill.
An act relating to athletic trainers.
House Bill number 146 is referred to Committee number 10, Labor. We're at that order of business of reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was... Let me start that over. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred as House Bill 69, Highway Funding, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, our legislators, Blickery, Eklund, Goggles, Kirkbride, Laux, Madden, and Petroff. Those who voted no, Northrop and Semlich. Signed by Representative Madden, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred to House Bill 112, Tip Distribution Policies, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Eklund, Goggles, Kirkbride, Laux, Madden, Northrop, Petroff, Semlich, and one excused, that was Blickery. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred to as House Bill 7, Sanitary Facilities for Motion Picture Operators, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those legislators who voted aye, Blevins, Davison, Freeman, Halverson, Hutchings, Yagi, Crone, Pieperinen, and one excused, that was Gay. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred to as House Bill 110, Off-Road Vehicle Gasoline Tax Distribution Sunset, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Those representatives who voted aye: Blevins, Davison, Freeman, Halverson, Hutchings, Yagi, Crone. Those who voted no: Pipirinen, and one excuse, Representative Gay. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred to as House Bill 10, Certificates of Insurance, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those representative voting aye: Blickery, Byrd, Green, Kirkbride, Paxton, Petroff, Danswanitzer. Those excused were Berger and Gay. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred to as House Bill 11, Insurance Holding Company System Regulatory Act, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those representative voting aye are Blickery, Byrd, Green, Kirkbride, Paxton, Petroff, and Danswanitzer. Excused were Berger and Gay. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom is referred House Bill 79, Collection of Unpaid Wages, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye: Representatives Coleman, Harvey, Kasparik, Reeder, and Wilson. Those who voted no: Barlow, Filer, Green, and Throne.
We're at that order of bills on second reading. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill number 12. House Bill number 12 having been read 2 separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 13. There is an amendment. Okay. The reading of the bill.
All right, this is House Bill number 12. An act relating to contagious and infectious diseases among livestock.
House Bill number 12 having been read 2 separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Now we're to the next bill for our consideration, House Bill number 13, the reading of the bill.
An act relating to livestock and other animals, revising the process for licensure of livestock markets as specified.
And there is an amendment. Representative Barlow.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of second reading amendment number 1 to House Bill 13. Mr. Speaker, we heard in Committee of the Whole there were some concerns with a particular section, with some work between the Wyoming Livestock Board, other legislators. We've come up with some suggested language. What this does, members, is clarifies there is a permit required from the Livestock Board, there is permission required from the landowner. The permit and the horses are then presented to an inspector for determination of ownership. At that time, all legal obligations of the gatherer are relieved, and the horses become the responsibility of the Wyoming Livestock Board. It also relieves, this is a bit of a new, but it relieves the requirement of permit if you're gathering unclaimed horses on your own property, but you still have the requirement to have them inspected and turn them over for proper. This also continues the part that says this does not apply to Bureau of Land Management horses. Mr. Speaker, I'll stand for any questions.
Representative Semlich, for your first time.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I commend the work of our two freshmen, the new freshman legislators who were previous members of the Livestock Board, for spending some time looking at this issue, and we consider this to be a friendly amendment and ask that you adopt it. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion? Further discussion? Question being called. All in favor of second reading amendment number 1 to House Bill number 13, please say aye. Opposed. Amendment has been adopted. We're back on the bill. House Bill number 13, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 14.
House Bill number 14, as introduced by the Judiciary, an act relating to crime victims' compensation.
House Bill 14, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 20.
House Bill number 20, as introduced by the Judiciary, an act relating to child support.
House Bill number 20, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 21.
House Bill number 21, as introduced by the Judiciary, an act relating to peace officers.
House Bill 21, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 54.
House Bill 54, as introduced by the Education Committee, an act relating to high school graduation requirements.
House Bill 54, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 59.
House Bill number 59, as introduced by the Minerals Committee, an act relating to banking and finance.
House Bill 59, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 68.
House Bill 68, as introduced by the Labor Committee, an act relating to the administration of government.
House Bill 68, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 80.
House Bill number 80, as introduced by the Transportation Committee, an act relating to the military department.
House Bill 80, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. We're now at that order of business of consideration of bills on general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House resolve itself into the Committee of the Whole.
You have heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House resolved itself to Committee of the Whole. Representative Burkhart.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, with regard to the general file agenda, the printed agenda that you have stands, and then add on to the end of that agenda the following bills: House Bill 112, House Bill 7, House Bill 110, House Bill 10, House Bill 11, House Bill 79, and House Bill 69. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. The Committee of the Whole will come to order. First bill for our consideration is House Bill 23. The reader will please read the bill.
House Bill number 23, as introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to crimes and offenses, modifying provisions relating to life sentences for juvenile offenders generally, eliminating life sentences without parole for juvenile offenders, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 23, Juvenile Parole Eligibility, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. The A's on House Bill 23 were Representative Connolly, Gingery, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Walters. Those who voted no were Baker and Watt.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 23 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. The Standing Committee Amendment corrected some of more clarification issues that we found in committee. I would ask you to let's go ahead and vote on the Standing Committee Amendment, and then we'll go from there.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 23, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries. We are back on the bill. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your box, you should see a document that says Miller versus Alabama on the top. And if you find that, I will now turn it over to the Vice Chairman of Judiciary, the representative from Park County, to explain the bill.
Representative Crone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think to begin with, in looking at this bill, it's good to review what the existing laws and what the existing standards are. So if a person is convicted of first-degree murder, there are really three penalties that are prescribed under Wyoming law. The first being the death penalty, second being life without the possibility of parole, the third being a life sentence. And I think it's important to look at life without parole versus a life sentence. Life without parole is just that. A governor cannot, or the executive downstairs cannot commute that sentence. That executive could pardon that person, potentially, but that is not a sentence that could be commuted. A life sentence, on the other hand, is a sentence which can be commuted by the governor or the executive downstairs. I'm a little rusty. I apologize. And once it becomes a term of years, that makes an inmate the possible gives the inmate the possibility of parole, and the parole board would hear the case for the ability to have parole. So the case that has been handed out is a case that a high court on the East Coast said that if you're charged with first-degree murder as a juvenile under the age of 18, it is unlawful for a mandatory life sentence to be imposed. This bill adopts that ruling and basically puts into effect that if you're charged with a first-degree murder as a juvenile, the life without the possibility of parole is not an option. Basically, it would become a life sentence. That life sentence could either be commuted by the governor or by the executive, or that life sentence, after a period of 25 years, would convert and you would be eligible to go before the parole board. So this bill is basically modifying our existing law for first-degree murder penalties that will comply with the court's ruling, and I would stand for any questions.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to point out one thing about this bill. We had testimony on this bill, and the ruling is that we cannot have a mandatory life sentence for children. It doesn't say that we can't have that as an option. So the reason why I voted against this bill is because I felt that there still needed to be that option in there.
Representative Crone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Without any further questions, I would ask that favorable consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Any further discussion on the bill? Question having been called, all of those in favor of House Bill 23, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 23 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 28. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill number 28, as introduced by the Travel Committee, an act relating to game and fish, providing for use of artificial lighting devices by persons with visual disabilities, providing for additional antelope licenses for disabled hunters, repealing restrictions on disabled hunter companion permits, and providing for an effective date. Your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 28, Disabled Hunter Programs, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those legislators who voted aye are Blevins, Davison, Freeman, Gay, Halverson, Hutchings, Yagi, Crone, and Piperinen.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Davison.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill number 28 do pass, and I'll turn the explanation of this bill over to the good representative from House District 22.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Halverson.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill number 28 passed unanimously out of the TRW committee. It relates to disabled hunters, specifically permitting the visually disabled hunter to employ a laser sight, which is currently prohibited. The use of a laser sight by an able hunter is still prohibited. Additionally, the committee voted to repeal the section of the statute which required a disabled hunter to name a hunter companion. This proved to be a burden on the disabled hunter in the event the named companion became unable to join the hunt. Deleting Title 23, Section 1, Chapter 23, permits the disabled hunter to employ any available companion hunter. Also, in House Bill number 28, we increased the number of antelope licenses available to nonprofit organizations who provide hunting opportunities to disabled hunters. We increased that from 30 to 50 antelope licenses. Finally, House Bill 28 allows landowners the use of a laser sight for the taking of predators on their own land. I'll stand for any questions.
Is there any discussion on the bill?
Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Davison's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 28 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 28 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 29. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill number 29 is introduced by the Travel Committee, an act relating to game and fish, repealing requirement for hunters to deliver landowner coupons to the department when antelope, deer, or elk are killed on federal or state land, and providing for an effective date. Your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 29, Game Licenses, Landowner Coupons, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those representatives who voted aye, Blevins, Davison, Freeman, Gay, Halverson, Hutchings, Yagi, Crone, Piperinen.
You've heard reading the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Davison.
I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill number 29 do pass, and I'll turn the explanation of this building over to my good representative from House District 25.
Thank you. Good morning.
Representative Blevins.
Speaker, Chairman, pardon me, Burkhardt. House Bill 29 simply repeals the requirement for hunters to deliver landowner coupons to the Game and Fish Department when antelope, deer, or elk are taken on federal and state land. It simply removes that burden from hunters to make a report to the Game and Fish, which they no longer use to gather information on kills in wildlife. And I'll stand for any questions.
Any further discussion on the bill? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Davison's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 29 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 29 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 40. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill number 40 is introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to eminent domain, extending the moratorium on the exercise of the power of condemnation for wind energy collector systems, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred to House Bill number 40, eminent domain wind energy collector systems, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, legislators Baker, Connolly, Croker, Crone, Miller. Those who voted no, Representative Gingery, Halverson, Walters, and Watt.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Gingery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 40 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, let's hold off on voting on that amendment until we've heard an explanation of the bill, because the amendment may be a little controversial. And I would turn over the explanation of the bill to the Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, this bill follows a long line of consideration on this subject. It was determined a number of years ago that eminent domain would apply to what are called collector systems in wind energy projects. And a collector system is the upstream system from the point where the molecules go into the grid. Once they go into the grid, they're freely transferable and they go wherever. Until the molecules go into the grid, they feed from the generation site into sometimes one time they consolidate and go into the grid. Sometimes they'll consolidate and then consolidate and then consolidate before they finally go on the grid. So, and the the place where they go in the grid is a substation, but there are substations upstream from the one where they go into the grid, which will be a place where a number of collector systems consolidate. Those collector systems have redundancy. We have what we call a radial system, which means that if you had five windmills, you'd have five wires that would go from the windmill to a substation where that would consolidate. However, that is not good engineering, and the engineers don't like a radial system because if one wire goes down, then you've lost at least that part of the transmission. So there are redundant systems that are put in place where they're all hooked together so that if one wire goes down, the power generation can be rerouted another way to the substation. The problem has arisen with respect to intermediate landowners. You have the one landowner on the one hand who has a choice whether to make a deal for wind generation on his property or not. Typically, that landowner has an economic benefit, and it's a great way for operators who own rural property to have another source of revenue from their property, put up windmills, take a royalty or a payment from those windmills, which is negotiated by the landowner. There's no threat of eminent domain, no velvet hammer, I call it. And he or she typically makes a pretty good deal for themselves. The problem is that the collector system may have to traverse other people's property. And when it traverses other people's property, the eminent domain, as our statute's currently written, would permit eminent domain, so that if a landowner between the generation facility and the substation is not willing or doesn't like the deal, eminent domain could force him to sell. And he doesn't have the same bargaining power that the landowner that put in the original generating system has because of the velvet hammer, the threat of eminent domain, and a very nominal or menial payment for the collector system intrusion across his property, and that's all he ever gets. So then we end up with a system where the molecules are going into the grid downstream someplace. The guy upstream on the high side with the generation facilities getting a check every month, ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. The landowner in the middle who has this collector system going across him got a one-time payment, and that's all that he gets. And we've looked at that a lot, and it's unfair. And the intermediate landowner, who's just as involved as the generation landowner, is being treated differently. So we've studied this for a long time. We had a select committee select task force on wind power and I was the House chairman of that committee. We spent 2 years studying the topic. There's a big report that's available on the Internet, if you'd ever care to look at it, that studied the topic. And we tried to resolve this in a way that was fair to all concerned. And at that point, we weren't able to arrive at a solution. So what we did was suspend the power of eminent domain against those intermediate landowners until we could see if we could figure out a solution. We suspended it once. We suspended it again. There are some ideas out there that are under consideration, but they aren't very well refined yet. So this time, I came with a bill just to get the thing off dead center and said, okay, what if we did this? What if we said to a wind power company, go out and make 85% of your deal without the velvet hammer. Go out there and bargain at arm's length, make whatever deal you can make, bargain back and forth, and if you can get 85% of the landowners committed, and if you can demonstrate to a court that you have a viable project so that you're not gaming the system, then we'll permit eminent domain to force the last 15% in, but the last 15% will pay the average of what was negotiated in arm's length transactions with all the other landowners. And that 85% was a give or take. It didn't have to be 85. That was just a place that we started. That was an analogy to some other things we use, like, for instance, road districts, improvement districts, where a certain percentage of the landowners are in favor of it, then the rest of the landowners can be forced into it. So I brought that to the committee this time, and we mulled it over and mulled it over, and nobody liked it. They didn't know what they liked. And so the question finally came up, well, what would be more acceptable, this bill in its form, or just kick the can down the road and extend for another 2 years? And the consensus was that they needed another 2 years. We heard a lot of testimony in committee before, and we heard a lot of testimony with the new Judiciary Committee, that these groups are hard at work. There is a concerted effort among landowner groups and wind energy groups and power groups to try to find a solution to this problem. So after they said that the choice was that not to consider that bill, but rather to have some extra time and the assurance to us that they were working hard on the problem, this is the bill that came out of committee, and it said that we'll extend the suspension until June 30 of 2015. That's 2 years. Now, in committee, then there was a standing committee amendment which passed to shorten that 2 years to 1 year. I think to try to get everybody on the burner and get them going and get something done one way or the other. And my reservation about that standing committee amendment is that it puts it on the budget cycle where it requires a two-thirds majority to be introduced. And that could be very difficult. That two-thirds majority for introduction frequently sinks bills that have merit that would pass by a majority but don't make the two-thirds. And so I continue to want, if we're going to continue this, my preference would be to have it continued 2 years, give these groups time to work, they give us assurance that they're working hard, and let us come back 2 years from now, not 1 year from now when it would be a two-thirds vote in order to get it introduced, but 2 years from now and put it in. And at that point, if the groups, then I agree, you know, if the groups cannot find a solution to the problem, then we as a body are finally going to have to make a decision. Are we going to have eminent domain for that situation, or are we not going to have it? But my hope is that they can find a way that is more fair to all property owners. And there are some novel theories out there. I don't think I'll waste your time with them now. But that 85-15 is not the only theory that's out there. There are some other theories out there that people are thinking about, and hopefully one of those would result in something that's fair to all the parties involved, which is the intermediate landowner who's getting run over in eminent domain, the power generation guy who can make a lot of money on his land if the collector system can be put in place, and the power company that's going to buy the power. Now, the other thing I'd say is that this suspension's been in effect for several years, and I haven't heard, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I have not heard, in my committee work, I've not heard of anybody whose project has been stifled by this. So I'm not sure that the suspension is really that harmful, and I would ask that you defeat the standing committee amendment and pass the bill, and I'd stand for any questions.
We're on standing committee amendment. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's extremely important that we look at diversifying our energy. And one of those can be wind energy. But as long as this moratorium is there, wind energy is at a stop. Without having the power of eminent domain, they can't move forward. Here's what happened. Back in 2010, we put the moratorium in place. I was all for it in 2010 because we were a little confused how this was going to work. We said, we'll put a moratorium on for 1 year. Come back after a year, still hadn't gotten worked out. So we put a two-year moratorium on there. So we're now about to end that two-year moratorium. So there's been a moratorium now for 3 years on, essentially, this is a moratorium on any wind energy development in the state of Wyoming. It's at a stop until we can resolve this. My hope was that we would find some solution. We haven't. It's time to pull the moratorium off and let things move forward. There's no need. Nobody's going to come to the table to negotiate so long as the moratorium is sitting there. Why would the landowner groups want to come to the table if they know the moratorium is sitting there? If you pull the moratorium off, it'll bring people back to the table to negotiate. The other important part, I think this actually violates the Dormant Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution.
Here's the problem. What you don't see here in this bill is if you go to that same statute, but you go to subsection A, and understand how eminent domain works. The sovereign, meaning the state, always has the ability to either take your property or the wonders of the Wyoming Constitution, you can partially take. So this would be a partial take. It makes sense for some things the state needs to do, or a county or a city. But we also give the power to certain utilities, because if you didn't give that power of eminent domain to a utility, they would never be able to get their gas pipeline or their electric transmission line across all those properties, because all you'd have to do is say no, and we would have no ability to get commerce moving across the state. So let's look at who can do it right now. So any person, association, company, or corporation may use condemnation to get out of necessity over and across lands for the location, construction, maintenance, use of reservoirs, drains, flumes, or ditches, okay, underground water pipelines, pumping stations, and other necessary appurtenances, canals, electric power transmission lines, and distribution systems. We'll come back to that one. Electric power transmission lines and distribution systems. But also railroad trackage, sidings, spur tracks, tramways, roads, or mine truck haul roads. Exploration drilling and production of oil and gas roads. Milling, electrical power transmission and distribution, domestic, municipal, or sanitary purposes. Or for the transportation of coal from any coal mine or railroad line. It goes on. So there's a whole bunch of things that you can, if you're a company, you're not the state, you're just a company, and I want to build a ditch to move water, or I want to build a railroad line, or I want to put a gas pipeline across the state. My company would have the power of eminent domain to come in and take that property. Now, of course, first I have to try good faith negotiations with the landowner, but if I can't get to that negotiation, my company would have the power of eminent domain. So we've said all these companies have the power, and we even say electrical companies have the power. Power companies have that power, except for if the power company is building a power line specifically for wind energy, then we say, no, you have no eminent domain. So what we've done is carved out this niche. We've said everybody else gets to do it, but if you're wind energy, you cannot use the power of eminent domain. And so what are we talking about? How much are we talking about? So once you get to a substation that's on the grid, you're good to go. So once you can get to that substation, you know, those lines are moving. So what you're trying to do is get from a wind farm, and you're trying to move that power down the line and get to the grid, somewhere along the line. You're going to have to cross some land. We do this already with other electric transmission lines. If this was an electric transmission line coming from a hydroelectric dam, or if this was an electric line coming from a coal power plant, they're perfectly allowed to go in right now and use eminent domain. The only people that can't use eminent domain is if the energy being produced is from wind. They can't use it. The other part I would point out is if you have a, certificate of public necessity and convenience. So some electric companies have a certificate of public convenience and necessity, which means that the Public Service Commission has said that they need to get their power and it's going to help the state of Wyoming. In that case, those electric companies can actually go ahead and use eminent domain for wind energy. So we're even making it more narrow. It's really only the merchant companies that aren't going to be able to use eminent domain. My point is that you're making it so narrow that I think there's some constitutional issues whether or not you're even allowed to do that. Number two, we've allowed this moratorium to go on for 3 years. They haven't found resolution. This is a vote not on eminent domain. This is a vote on, do you want wind energy in the state of Wyoming or do you not? It's real simple. If you vote against this bill, the moratorium goes off and wind energy can start up again. If you vote for this bill, you're voting for the moratorium, and wind energy is still dead in its tracks. As a compromise, what the committee said was, what if we did an amendment instead of a 2-year moratorium, a 1-year moratorium? Now, personally, I'm going to vote no on the bill, but if you're not willing to go that far, at least take a serious look at adopting the standing committee amendment. Let's make it a one-year moratorium and get back here next year and talk about this. And if we as a body do not want wind energy in this state, that's fine. Let's make that real clear. Let's let everyone know we're not diversifying our economy. We're not doing diversification here. We are a one-track mind. But if we want to diversify and we want wind energy, this is the way to do it. Get rid of the moratorium.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask our good majority leader for just a little clarity. There's a lot of information out there. First of all, if I understood correctly, the joint committee, this is their best effort and had 2 years in it. Additionally, those that are involved in the industry across the board are also saying 2 years is probably what they need. And if that was accurate in his description of the bill when he presented it, I would urge that we stay with the bill and avoid shortening the moratorium.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, in response to those questions, the groups are working hard. They assured us all that they're working hard. I forget the rest of the question. Anyway, we do need the 2 years. I feel strongly that we need the 2 years, mostly because of the introduction barrier next year, but also because these negotiations are just taking time.
A reminder, we are on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, point of order. I don't believe the amendment's been moved yet, but it has been moved. Okay. On the Standing Committee Amendment, Mr. Chairman, this was a compromise in the committee. These folks have had a couple of years to try to come to some sort of terms to work this out. I was going to be a no on the bill if we didn't get this Standing Committee Amendment on there. I may still be a no, even if we get it on there. But this amendment is going to put a lot of pressure on the parties to get something done before the next budget session. And it's going to have to be something that's in pretty good agreement, because it's going to take a 2-thirds vote here on the floor to even hear a bill to prevent this eminent domain going back into effect for these merchant power producers that are installing these wind turbines across the state. So if you want to have a chance to let these guys negotiate before the budget session in 1 year, this is the way to do it. So vote aye on the amendment. And then if you don't want the bill and want eminent domain to be able to be used right now, vote no on the whole bill.
Representative Baker, are you waiting?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to echo a little bit of what he said. I think we're here to make tough decisions. This wind energy is an issue that affects our future. I propose this amendment, and I think it's important that these agencies and these two groups know that we're serious about them negotiating a deal. We can kick the can down the road for 2 more years, and we can kick it down 2 more years, but eventually we've got to come to a resolution here, so I support this amendment.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I served on the interim committee, the joint House and Senate side committee, and the agreement was made that if we put forward a 2-year extension, we can then therefore not go with that 85% part of the bill. There was agreement between industry, there was agreement between the citizens who came and testified. And we heard heard interim topic for hours of people testifying, and that was the general agreement, is that we do not have a bill to go forward in front of the legislature. And since we do not have that to go forward, With a two-thirds vote needed on introduction next year, essentially the moratorium will die next year, and industry has an unfair advantage, and there is testimony that there isn't good faith dealing already. So therefore, to make it equal, we extended the moratorium for 2 years. This industry is heavily dependent upon the federal government. Without the 23 cents on the dollar subsidy, this industry would fail within our state. So therefore, with it being in flux, and it just getting passed within the last couple of weeks, the federal subsidy, we thought, let's go forward with a two-year extension. And therefore, I am on and against changing it to just a one-year extension.
Chairman Semlich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the bill and against the amendment. You know, words have meaning in this House, and listening to the majority floor leader in his presentation, it's a very powerful comment that he made, and he just simply said that to his knowledge there hadn't been any wind development in Wyoming that hasn't occurred as a result of them not having eminent domain. So I think that's powerful. For one thing, if we can encourage in this body discussions about settlements between two parties without bringing eminent domain in there, I think our state is just better for it. Obviously, there are times when that's necessary, but it just changes the scope of the discussions to a point where it usually skews them off one direction or another. If there has not been a problem, I guess I'm not real sure what we're trying to fix here. Let's give it another couple years. The process aspect that's been mentioned with respect to the budget session is real, and I think for those two points, I think we ought to move forward with the bill and vote down the standing committee amendment.
On the standing committee amendment, Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would urge you to vote for the amendment and then vote no on the bill. But definitely, let's get that amendment in. Here's the issue with getting a deal done. Everyone keeps saying that we're supposed to bring these groups together and make a deal as to how they're going to get reimbursed. Remember, the deal they're talking about is only for wind energy transmitter lines, just for those lines. So if I'm building a coal-fired power plant or hydroelectric dam, same line. There's no distinction. Just where the energy came from is different. The same line crossing my property, there is no deal today. So if I built a line coming from a dam and I'm moving energy over that line, I don't have to make any deal with you. I don't have to do this 85-15 unitization. I pay you like I pay any other easement. I pay for what is seen as the fair market value. Why are we making it so wind energy is so different than any other type of energy? And the other issue as to whether or not wind energy will survive or not without the federal subsidies, I think that's probably a correct statement, that if they weren't getting the federal subsidies, they probably would have a very difficult time. So I'm not arguing that. What I'm arguing is we've put up another roadblock in their way of not allowing the eminent domain to move forward. Whether or not you agree with wind energy or not, I don't know about that. We did have testimony. It is correct that the testimony was that no wind projects are moving forward. But they did testify they're allowing all their leases to lapse. They're just not renewing their leases. So what they do is they go out and they negotiate that, hey, potentially we might want to build a wind farm here. You enter into an initial lease with that landowner because you have to do a lot of testing. You have to put up some tests and you have to run them for a few years to see if that's going to be a good spot for you. They're just letting their leases lapse because what their testimony was that Wyoming is sending a strong message. We are strongly against wind energy. We are strongly against diversifying our energy portfolio in the state of Wyoming. This bill continues to send that strong message. I would urge you to vote for the amendment and vote no on the bill.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Representative Nicholas.
Just a brief note. I also served on the interim committee. And quite frankly, I think the discussion has almost landed on its head now. the industry supported the bill and supported the two-year extension. That was industry's position. And we worked hard with them to get a bill, but we couldn't get to it. So they asked us, please do this, work with us, so we can work with landowners and get this done. So this is an accommodation to industry. We're actually trying to help the transmission line issue survive industry's complaints as opposed to being obstructionist about it. And once it's interesting to me that, you know, you get new committees. Now the judiciary is made up of a different crew. We sat through all these things, and for three different times we went through all the testimony, and I would submit that you're not getting the whole story as it was presented to us in the agreements that we reached why we did it. And so I would, against the amendment, for the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, on the amendment only, just one final thought. We think the majority rules in this body, but if we kick this can ahead only 1 year, then it does, the majority does rule. One-third, it requires a two-thirds vote for introduction, so that means it's not the majority next year that decides whether the moratorium is going to be dealt with or not. It's a minority. One-third can kill it. That's why I think we need to go 2 years, simply to put it on the playing field that we all understand the majority rules. So I would ask you to vote against the standing committee amendment.
You've heard the motion on the standing committee amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Standing committee amendment number one has been defeated. We are back on the bill. Representative Croker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the bill, I want to point out one difference that it does make wind energy different from the other types of energy that have been mentioned. If those of you who were members of the 61st body, you'll remember the apples versus broccoli, you know, comparison that we had. But the big difference is when it's a coal fire power plant, a dam, whatever the case may be, you have one central location where you have a power line that's going out to take power to a community that otherwise wouldn't have power. The difference with wind energy is you get all these collector sites, so you can have dozens or more different locations generating the power, and all those lines go back to a central location that then uses the lines to take power to those communities. So it's potentially much more disruptive than just one line carrying power somewhere. It can be impact dozens and dozens of landowners instead of a smaller number. I think if we're going to err, we need to err on the side of protecting private property rights, so I would encourage you to vote for the bill.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, on and against the bill. In response to that last comment, I think conceptually, it sounds like a good argument. In reality, that is not the truth. In reality, what you see is the development of wind farms, usually on a single tract of land because that's most economical, and then power lines running from that designated wind farm of 60 to 120 or whatever turbines to a central collecting system. So this is not materially different than any other energy form that we allow condemnation for, whether it be pipeline or other types of condemnation. And I think it's also important to say that, you know, understand what eminent domain is. There's been arguments that, oh, these guys are out there, you know, it's open for them to condemn in bad faith and to negotiate in bad faith. No, it isn't. The same requirements that apply to every other condemning authority across the state applies to these folks. And those requirements include a requirement that they negotiate in good faith. And we have included in statute a number of sort of checkoffs that ensure that when somebody is in negotiating, they don't just come in and drop the hammer of eminent domain. They have to negotiate in good faith. And that's part of the law that everybody has to follow who has condemning authority. I think it's also a little bit of a false argument to assume that there's just over the hill, there's a magic solution to this problem. You just have to look at the history that the good majority floor leader recited to you, that back in 2010, it's not just that we passed this prohibition, it's that we passed this prohibition and assigned a task force specifically to look at this issue with members from the Senate, members from the House, members that were appointed by the governor's office, and we met. I was on that task force, and we met a number of times throughout the interim. We heard from all sides of the issue, and at the end, completely inconclusive. Not only inconclusive as to whether there was a good common sense solution to this problem, but whether there was even a problem at all. And so we came to that next session, and of course there was no solution. There was no bill. And so we passed another prohibition with the promise that two more years, we can get a solution to this thing, and we can come back to you and ensure that this isn't a problem. Well, sure enough, here we are 2 years later, and we hear the same argument. All we need is just another 2 years. That's all we need. What becomes clear through that pattern is that the goal is not a solution, if there is even a problem. The goal is the prohibition itself. And so, you know, if you're looking at a common approach, you know, either no eminent domain for anybody, or let's allow folks to access eminent domain on equal footing. Either we're going to say, you, because you aren't a public utility, you don't get the right of condemnation, or you, person B, you're going to build that exact same line, the exact same way, have the exact same impact, but you get the power of eminent domain. And that's the sort of picking of winners and losers that we're doing through this legislation. So, you know, we have given time, and if there is really a problem, I guarantee that if there's not a prohibition, if those impacts are imminent, we will certainly reach a solution. So I just ask you to vote no on the bill.
Representative Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hopefully my voice holds out. I think this is not a policy decision on wind energy. It is a policy decision on eminent domain. And the previous speaker, I think, said that well. Eminent domain is something that should be exercised by government, public utility. This has been interpreted by the Attorney General's office to reach out to these collector lines, which for the benefit of private business. And that's where I have such difficulty here. The right of using eminent domain in this realm really troubles me. The right to go in and take away a landowner's individual rights for the benefit of private business really, really bothers me. And I've spoken on this and talked on this numerous times, and I just ask you to consider that when you cast your vote. And I'd encourage you to vote for this bill. Valid point. I don't know if the parties will ever get together and find a resolution, but I do not support or like the use of eminent domain in this particular area. Thank you.
Representative Barlow.
Mr. Chairman, a question for the majority floor leader, rhetorically, if you will, but certainly welcome to answer it, is does a power generation, a wind power generation facility, turbines, etc., have the right of eminent domain currently? If you answer that question, if the answer to that question is no, then why would we provide it for the takeaway system? If the answer is yes, then obviously you come to a different conclusion. You could come to a different conclusion. So that's probably fundamental in my mind about this is, does a power generator have the right to eminent domain to place their turbines on someone's land utilizing what we call eminent domain takings? Thank you.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that brings up a very interesting point, and that's one of the things that I argued one time, although I don't like the solution. But if we're going to have eminent domain associated with these wind energy systems, then why is it that use of eminent domain can be made for the collector lines but not for the generation facility itself? And it's been determined that that is not within the power of eminent domain. So I said, you know, we could go the other way and stretch it back the other way, which would take all the fun out of it for everybody and just say a company can come in and condemn the wind generation site and condemn the collector site. Nobody liked that. Least of all, the landowners who were going to make arm's length transactions and bargain and deal and get a contract that was to their liking without the velvet hammer of eminent domain for the generation facility as opposed to the other. Now, this is a very narrow exception to eminent domain. And it really addresses, it really narrows down to one thing, and that's neighbor against neighbor, and trying to find a solution that puts neighbors on an equitable basis. It doesn't affect the use of eminent domain by public utilities and companies that hold what's called a certificate of public need and necessity. Well, why is that? Those are public companies. Their boards do business in public. There's an opportunity for public input. And furthermore, those companies are all governed by the PSC, and the PSC regulates how they do their business and how they set their rates and what they do. All those are exempted because there are public checks and balances on what they're doing. There's no public check and balance on this neighbor-to-neighbor business. And that's what we're down to, is neighbor-to-neighbor. Now, it's not a moratorium on wind energy. It's not an attack on the wind industry. It's not designed to shut down the wind industry. Two of the biggest projects that are pending in the state of Wyoming right now don't involve collector lines on their neighbor's property because they encompass, those projects encompass a property that reaches all the way from the generation facility to where it goes into the grid. So there's no intrusion across the neighbor's land for a collector system. These are those specialized situations where it's neighbor against neighbor. And one neighbor is going to profit at the expense of another. One neighbor is going to get a big check on a monthly basis. His neighbor who has to host the collector signs or lines is going to get a one-time payment, and that's it. And I just don't buy this thing about a fair bargaining power when eminent domain's involved. Just think about it yourself. If somebody comes to you and says, we're going to take this property the easy way, or we're going to take it the hard way. And if you make it too hard, we'll just go deposit the money in court right now and take it, and then you can fight to your heart's content over how much of the money you ought to get, but the collector line's getting built. That is not an arm's length negotiation. And it's an affront to private property rights. So for all those reasons, I ask you to consider this bill. Think about the neighbor-to-neighbor, because that's what it's really about. I ask you to pass this bill.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those of you that have been here before will find it kind of surprising that this guy from House District 55 is up here almost defending wind energy. I've probably been the biggest opponent of wind energy up here, but this is kind of a fairness issue. In answer to the gentleman from House District 3, yes, people right now, companies right now, have the power of eminent domain for collector systems within Wyoming right now, the ones that are regulated by the Public Service Commission. The merchant vendors don't have the power of an eminent domain. So it's, to me, kind of a fairness issue. That's why I am not supporting this bill. This get rid of this eminent domain moratorium right now and let things get on. If they can stand on its own 2 feet with the federal tax breaks that are occurring, let it happen. They've discussed this for 4 years. I just don't think it's this body's position to kick the can down the road like they do back east. You know, it's just not the right thing. Just make a decision right now. The decision should be to kill this bill and let eminent domain be practiced in Wyoming.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one final comment on this argument that, the neighbor-to-neighbor issues that are incorporated in wind development. And certainly there are, but that's no different than any other industry we have in the state. It's no different than, 100 years ago when somebody had to condemn a road out to get their cattle off the property. Their neighbor didn't get to benefit from that, but they had that power. And it's no different than if my neighbor drills a well on their property and I just am not lucky enough by luck and happenstance to be on a mineral deposit. They build in a pipeline right across my property, and they benefit, and their neighbor impacts experiences some of that impact. That's no different than here. So if you vote that these collector systems, we're just not going to allow eminent domain, you've got to be ready to take that next step and say, okay, yeah, we're going to stop pipelines, we're going to stop everything else too, because that's the whole scheme for eminent domain. You have an impact on your neighbor, but you're required to pay fair market value for that impact. And so, again, the argument that this is something different than we've seen over the last 100 years, it really isn't. It's the same thing, and I'd ask you to treat it the same way by voting no on the bill.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's interesting to see House Majority Leadership, one for, one against, and one giving a history lesson. Eminent domain was something that wasn't really favored in the law and didn't happen and evolved. And it evolved because most of our law evolved from English common law, where the king owned everything. And so you didn't need eminent domain. And there's actually precedent that's valid in Wyoming that says that one government entity can't condemn another government entity because the king owns everything and the king can't condemn himself. Well, so what happened was we had big landowners traditionally who controlled everything. And you couldn't have any commerce because you couldn't get across the big landowners. And that evolved over time. And it found its way into the Wyoming Constitution during the Wyoming Constitutional Convention. And you can find that in Article 1, Section 32 of the Constitution that says private property shall not be taken for private use unless by the consent of the owner, except for private ways of necessity and for reservoirs, drains, flumes, or ditches on or across lands of others, for agricultural, mining, milling, domestic, or sanitary purposes, nor in any case without due compensation. Well, what happened was our technology evolved. We were using flues to run logs down hills into the river to make railroad ties. We started producing oil in Wyoming in the 1880s, and all of a sudden, instead of hauling oil by wagon, we created pipelines. And one of the first pipelines in Wyoming was from Midwest to Casper and the oil field there, to the refineries in the big town in the middle of the state. Well, so what we did is we granted it by statute, and you can find this in your statutes at 126.815, the right of condemnation necessary for the location, construction, maintenance for reservoirs, drains, flumes, ditches, including return flow and wastewater ditches, underground water pipelines, pumping stations, and those other necessary appurtenances, canals, electric power transmission lines and distribution systems, railroad trackage, sidings, spur tracks, tramways, roads, or mine haul truck roads, required in the course of their business for agricultural, mining, exploration, drilling, or the production of oil and gas, milling, electric power transmission and distribution, domestic or municipal sanitary purposes, or for the transportation of coal from any coal mine or railroad line for the transportation of oil or gas from any well. Now, we have evolved over time condemnation rights for different things. For oil and gas, we call it unitization. And if you have the consent of a certain number of people to participate in drilling a well or creating a unit, you can suck the other people in involuntarily, and there's a penalty that we charge for them not participating in the unit. And you can find those in Title 30. You can't condemn for a coal mine, although most of our minerals are owned by the federal government. And as you know, the mineral rights are dominant over the reasonable surface use. And so if the coal mine, if the federal government leases for mining of coal, you have the right to use so much of the surface as is necessary to mine the coal. But we were finding, and there's an interesting debate between the biggest railroad in our state and the former governor from the southwest part of the state and the former U.S. senator from the northwest part of the state on how to get through corners, because they owned corners, and whether to mine through corners. And what that was an evolution in technology. And now we're faced with another evolution in technology. And for 3 years now, we've said, well, we can't figure this out. We better see what we can do here to see if we can figure it out. The question is, do you want to wait one more year to figure it out, 2 more years to figure it out, or have no figure it out now and just say you can have the condemnation. It seems to me that the amendment, when we get on that, would be the appropriate thing to do. Wait one more year, say, folks, figure it out. If you don't figure it out, then you'll just have the right of condemnation. But that's just my thought.
Any further discussion on the bill? Majority floor leader.
Mr. Chairman, just one more thought. I heard the statement made, well, it's time it stood on its own 2 feet. Well, that's the point. A project never stands on its own 2 feet entirely when it's backed by the velvet hammer of eminent domain. And it's a neighbor-to-neighbor situation. What we're trying to figure out is a way to make it more equitable, where all the neighbors involved, all sharing the prosperity that comes from this project. And so I would ask your support on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 40 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The Chair is in doubt. All those in favor, please stand. House Bill 40 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, privilege of the floor.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, we are honored, and believe me, it's a special honor for those of us who served with him. In the back gallery, would you please recognize former Speaker of the House, Roy Cohey, and his wife, Barbara.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 60. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill number 60 is introduced by the Minerals Committee. An act relating to trade and commerce, amending the Wyoming Money Transmitters Act, authorizing the use of subdelegates by authorized delegates of licensees under the Money Transmitters Act, providing authority of the Banking Commissioner over subdelegates, providing a definition, and providing for an effective date. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred to House Bill 60, Money Transmitters Act Amendments, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those legislators who voted aye, Byrd, Kennedy, Greer, Kasparic, Larson, Lockhart, Reed, Summers, and Winters.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 60 do pass. And I turn the management and explanation of the bill over to the good legislator from Washakie County.
Representative Greer.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I suspect this will be a little less controversial. What we do, we have some cleanup amendments here. Again, we're dealing with consumer protection code, credit code. Money transmitters are, if I can get this explained right, they're organizations. And maybe I better stop here because I did get it handed out. In your box, it's got my House District 27 on it, is this diagram. If I explain the business here, it'll be very easy to explain the bill. And there are two types of money transmitters. One are the large national organization where you wire your funds from one location in the country to another. And that has been historically a money transmitter. That money transmitter is licensed to the state of Wyoming because they are handling our funds, the consumers' funds, and they would contract with the location down on the corner to receive the money and wire it across the country to another location. Well, as we're finding this whole session, technology and ideas are growing, and something that you will see now is when you walk into a grocery store, you see that kiosk where you can buy cards, prepaid credit cards, or cards to go to a national hardware store for X number of dollars, or to buy music off the internet or books from those chains. Everybody with me? Okay. And so what we have are national or large organizations within the nation that go together and put together these cards, and then they go out to middlemen who say, you know, within the state of Wyoming, I'm going to round up these cards, and I'm going to take them and go to all the different local stores and convenience stores and put them up for sale to the public. Well, our statutes require the money transmitters to be licensed, and then what are called the delegates to be licensed. That's the middleman in that scenario. But they do not account for the sub-delegates. And these are all contractual relationships. So what what our commission that oversees this wants to do, make sure that we have everybody accountable. So if you go to the grocery store, buy one of those prepaid cards, the consumer's turning over their money. They just want to make sure that they are overseeing that consumer's money all the way from where it is paid over at the grocery store, all the way up until the time that you finally get to go to the hardware store and buy your 2x4. So that's what you'll see in this bill, are simply the insertion of subdelegates, authorizing those. The other component, and then a definition of subdelegate. The other item I'll point out that is a minor cleanup is on page 5 of the bill. We have established before with prior cleanups that the term of payment instrument includes these types of cards, and we are striking the term and stored value. And the reason for that is that term stored value is within the meaning of payment instruments. And it's always good not to, you know, as a legislature, our courts will say, well, if you left that in there, you must have for a reason. And we don't want that in there. We just to clean up on that. So any questions on this? I think I can answer them.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not really a question, but just a little further explanation. As you know, the Banking Commission is responsible for these things. They're going through an effort of updating their processes so that they capture the new technologies and the changes in the industry. And certainly the subdelegates is a change in the industry. And this just puts that so it's clear and that our citizens have a way of protection when they use one of these subdelegates as a money transmitter. And I urge your support of the bill.
Representative Greer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I may, the good representative from House District 3 asked a very good question, and one that I forgot to raise. On page 3 of the bill, again, we're talking about the Uniform Consumer Credit Code in consumers, and so we have a correction there to make sure that the license in this area we're dealing with for personal, family, or household use. Again, that's the scope of the entity that oversees us, is the consumer area, not, again, between businesses. Very good question, and I apologize for not explaining that the first run. Thank you.
Any further discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 60 do pass, please say aye. Those opposed, no. House Bill 60 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 111. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 111, as introduced by Representative Petroff, an act relating to labor and employment, providing for tips and gratuities as specified to be excluded from sales tax as specified, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 111, Tips and Gratuities-Sales Tax, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Legislators who voted aye: Eklund, Goggles, Kirkbride, Laux, Madden, Northrop, Petroff, and Semlick. Excused was Blickery.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report, you do so with the recommendation that bill number, House Bill 111, do pass. And there is an amendment, but in the sake of efficiency, I will have the sponsor explain the amendment as well as the bill. And I guess I'll turn it over to the representative from House District 16 for this explanation.
Chairman Madden, will you move the amendment or will the sponsor?
Do I have to move it? I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 111 for consideration.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the amendment, there are just a couple of things. The first is on page 1, line 1, it's changing that it's an act related to taxation instead of an act related to labor and employment because it is in that section of the statutes in section 39. The second section of the amendment moves the word cover charges from after the change to before the change so that it's clear that cover charges do remain a taxable item. So if there are no questions on the amendment, I'll call for the question on the amendment.
Question having been called on amendment number, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 111. All those in favor, please say aye. Those opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 111 addresses the issue of sales tax on gratuities in food service establishments only. Currently, sales tax on gratuities is not addressed in statute, and the statutes that we do have support the Department of Revenue's position on these items, but once again, it's not directly addressed in statute. The interpretation of the current statutes by the Department of Revenue say that if you leave a tip at a restaurant, it is not subject to sales tax, but if the tip is predetermined or pre-invoiced by the restaurant, then it is subject to sales tax. So this would be for those things at the bottom of a menu that say for parties of 8 or more, an 18% gratuity will be added. So the important thing to remember is that this is a tax paid by the consumer, and the question is, should the consumer have to pay sales tax on a gratuity simply because the restaurant determined the gratuity rather than them leaving the gratuity? So a couple more important things to remember. The tips are owned by the servers. That's federal law. It's state law now, and it will continue to be state law regardless of what happens with the next bill. It spells out who can receive the tips in terms of which service employees. We tax those tips pretty well already. The employee has to pay income tax, Social Security, and Medicare. The employer has to pay Social Security, Medicare, federal unemployment, state unemployment, and workers' compensation. And those things are all the same whether or not the tip is pre-invoiced or paid by the customer. So there is a fiscal note on this, and my assumption was that it was prepared by the Department of Revenue, but we learned in committee that it was not. Was I allowed to say? So there was testimony in the committee that this would be an indeterminable number because it's not segregated out. But the reason this issue came up is there have been a lot of audits of restaurants where they're learning that this tip is owed. Now, it's clearly spelled out in the department's regulations that mandatory tips are to be taxed. But for restaurants, that term mandatory tip has been very confusing because typically when they invoice a tip, a lot of times the customer will cross out the tip, change it, make it more than it is, make it less than it is if they receive bad service, and the restaurant doesn't question those changes. The other confusing thing is when does it become mandatory versus not mandatory when it is changed. So let's say you add an 18% gratuity on, the customer crosses it out and adds another 5%. Well, is the 5% not subject to sales tax, but the 18% is? Is the whole amount now voluntary tip? So there's a lot of confusion about it, but the ultimate question is, do you think that consumers should have to pay a sales tax on a tip? So this basically spells out no sales tax on tips, regardless of whether invoiced by the restaurant or offered by the customer. So I'll stand for any questions.
Any further discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Madden's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 111 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 111 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 112. The reader will please read the bill.
House Bill 112, as presented by Representative Petroff, an act relating to labor and employment, authorizing employers to set policies regarding tip and gratuity pooling and distribution as specified, and providing for an effective date. Your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 112, tip distribution policies, respectfully reports same back to the House for the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Legislators who voted aye are Eklund, Goggles, Kirkbride, Laux, Madden, Northrop, Petroff, and Semlich. One excuse, and that was Representative Blickery.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Madden?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 112, House Bill 112, do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment.
You've heard the motion on Standing Committee Amendment. Is there any discussion? Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Standing Committee Amendment basically does three things. First of all, on page 2, line 10, it deletes from eligible people to receive tips, chefs if they prepare food at tableside. The second thing it does is on page 3 in section 5, it talks about service industries and it defines other service industries. It basically takes dude ranches and makes it into guest ranches, and it lists the statute that defines guest ranches. It deletes spas because we have the definition there for a whirlpool, not the intended definition of a vacation resort. So we substituted the word vacation resort. And finally, the third change changes it from being effective July 1st to being effective immediately upon completion of all acts necessary. And the motivation behind this was that this would be in the middle of tourist season and it would be difficult to implement at that time.
Representative Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is my brief experience here. I'm concerned with it being put into effect immediately, just simply from a training standpoint to all the various employers out throughout the state. I know when we've had other departments need to get this information out and just enough time for the employers to make the adjustment. And I'm in favor of this bill, but I just question that component of the amendment, and maybe a little further explanation would be helpful.
Representative Barlow.
Mr. Chairman, on and against this bill strikes three things. Seems like a redistribution of someone's earnings. Redistributor has all the power, and and no skin in the game. They're relieved of responsibility to pay the folks that they are actually responsible for hiring. So three things I'd like you to consider in this respect. Thank you.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just regarding the amendment and the question on the amendment, because it is allowing restaurant owners to do something different than they're doing and not demanding that they do it, I don't think that, you know, there are no material changes in that. The material changes would be in the department that enforces that being able to develop rules. I can't answer how difficult that would be for them.
Representative Greer.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to divide the amendment with lines 1 through 16 being the first division, and then 17 through 22 is the second division.
Okay. The amendment is divisible at the point suggested by the representative. Which would you like to take first?
Mr. Chairman, as I'm overall in favor of this completely, I just think maybe we should think, I'd like to take the second division first and discuss that and vote on that if pleases the chair. And that's just, I know to get that information out to everybody just takes a little bit of time. I understand the inconvenience of the employers in this industry having to switch over, but again, just give them some time to think about that and make sure everybody fully understands this legislation and the impacts and what they can and cannot do. And I'd encourage you to defeat them, the second division, vote no.
Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regard to that second division, the logic that we used on that was the fact that we had a enabling date of July 1, as I recall. And in the tourism industry, July 1 is kind of right in the middle of the tourism industry. So the idea was that we would make it effective so they have time to, you know, if they want to, they don't have to, like we say, but if they want to, they can engage in this, but they don't need to wait until the middle of the tourist season and say, well, all your employees in here, what we want to do now is change the way the tips are distributed. And it just, it made sense now if you want to make it April 1 or May 1, I guess, you know, we can debate that, but it needs to be occurring before the middle of the summer.
We are on Section 2 of the divided amendment. Is there any further discussion? You've heard the motion on Standing Committee Amendment Section 2. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Section 2 of the Standing Committee Amendment has passed the Committee of the Whole. We are now on Section 1. Is there any further discussion on Section 1? Having heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment, are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having raised 4 daughters, 3 of them that were waitresses, I can tell you that although this bill says it's optional, that I've seen multiple employers that make it mandatory. And when you're talking about young girls who are waiting tables, they just have to do what they're told. When you look at the wages across the food industry, you have the waitresses on the lowest pay scale of all. And the only way they have to make up that difference is through their tips. When they're required to redistribute their tips to the cooks, who make considerably more than they do, the dishwashers, who make more than they do, the bussers that make more than they do, and the hostesses that make more than they do, it seems unfair to me that they would have to.
But I do have to tell you that I had two daughters that recognized that if they shared their tips with the cook would hurry with their food and the food came out looking nice. If they redistributed their tips voluntarily to the busboys, then the tables in their section were cleared quickly and cleanly, and they were ready to be reseated, and so they were able to wait on more people and make more money in the night. And so I just think that this is unfair to waitresses, and I also think that people who wait tables are either among the poorest among us, or they are very young, and very makes it very difficult to stand up to an employer who says, well, the law says we can do this, so we're doing it. So I'm adamantly opposed to the bill.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, I had not done the bill explanation yet. I was just explaining the amendments initially. So if I may take a moment of your time to explain the bill. House Bill 112, this is dealing with a statute that was written in 1957. And it was probably written, if you read the way that it's phrased, that the tips are the sole property of the employee or the employees who received them. It was likely written in response to some nefarious owner who was trying to take tips from his or her employees. And so it's specified that the tips are the sole property of the employee or the employees who received them, and the intent was to protect the service employees who earned the tips. And that is still the intention with this bill, is to protect the service employees who earned these tips. All we're trying to do is allow the employers who are closest to the operations in their own businesses to have a determination in who actually earned that tip. We're only one of three states that either inadvertently or intentionally have statutes that prevent this. So 47 other states allow employers to determine who earned that tip. Now, back to 1957, when they were writing it, they could not have anticipated that there would be coffee shops with tip jars on the counter, or that there would be professionally trained sommeliers who helped people decide what kind of wine to get at the front end of a fine meal. I worked as a waitress in the early 80s, and I worked at a place where we did everything ourselves. We poured the water, we, you know, got all the drinks, we served everything ourselves, we cleared the tables ourselves, and it's not an efficient way to run a restaurant, which is why we have so many auxiliary service employees now. And these auxiliary service employees help the servers to earn their tips. They help them to earn more tips because they speed up the process. They help them to turn over more tables. They help give better service to the customers, which helps the servers earn their tips. There are 100 different configurations of the way that an owner might or a manager might set up this service arrangement, which is why it makes sense to let them make the determination of who earned the tip. And this bill extends beyond food service industries. How do you interpret tips and gratuities received by a guest ranch or a tour operator? And again, the employer is in the best position to figure out a fair distribution system for his or her employees. So going over the bill, and I'll do it fairly quickly, but on page 2 is where it basically starts to say that, yeah, the same thing is in effect. We're still giving the tips to the server and the servers who earn them. But this requirement shall not prevent an employer from setting and enforcing policies regarding tip pooling and distribution of tips and gratuities among staff directly serving customers. And then it goes on to describe in Romanet 1, food service establishment personnel directly serving customers, and it defines them as wait staff, bus staff, service bartenders, hosts, and counter personnel. It doesn't say and other people. It specifies those people who have direct contact with the customer and have had a direct impact on the tip. That comes directly from the Department of Labor Field Operations Handbook regarding the Fair Labor Standards Act, those definitions. And they actually have additional definitions which we have not included, like the chefs who prepare food at tableside. Romanet 2, a tip and gratuity pooling and distribution policy shall not provide for tips
to people not directly serving customers, including but not limited to dishwashers, kitchen staff, and janitors. So we're specifically excluding from the pool anybody who is not directly involved in serving customers. Romanette 3, where one individual is the primary server, that individual shall not be required to contribute more than 15% of their tips and gratuities to a pool. Now, that's the maximum that they would be required to contribute, would be 15%. So if there's an arrangement, we had somebody testify in the committee who said, well, I have one restaurant that wouldn't be an appropriate number because the servers do most of the work. I have another restaurant where there are a lot of servers involved in serving a table where that would be the appropriate number. But once again, we're allowing the employer to make that determination. On page 3, Romanette 4, it specifies that the employees all have to receive minimum wage. And that minimum wage with tips and employer paid wages, and that only the amount in excess of that is subject to tip pooling. And finally, it goes on to specify other industries where employers are allowed to make policy. And we've heard of ridiculous stories like people tipping at the end of a week-long guest ranch stay, and the owners have run into trouble with setting policies regarding distribution of tips. So they make the customer define who gets that tip at the end of a week-long stay at a guest ranch. So, you know, I don't know, the wrangler, the server, it's an impossible situation. Two other quick points before I take questions, but tip pooling and sharing is already happening. It is the culture in restaurants. And so what is happening for us, the one of three states that does not allow this, is that there's a loosely run system where either people just tip out voluntarily, or there's an informal tipping pool. And that happens fairly frequently, where the employees get together and they say, we're going to give X percent of tips to the auxiliary service employees. Well, the problem with that is it really makes the employers vulnerable. We've heard of lawsuits where a disgruntled employee will then turn around and say, well, that wasn't the employer's pool. I mean, the employee's pool. The employer set that up. And it creates a lot of legal vulnerabilities for the employers. The other thing is taxation of tips. In the 80s, the federal government started cracking down on employers regarding reporting of tips. And so they expect in a restaurant situation that there will be at least 15% of tips reported. Well, it's a very difficult thing to track when employees are trading money back and forth and there is no system for it. So we heard of one instance in our committee where the employer charged all of the taxes to the waiters and waitresses, regardless of how they distributed them, because he couldn't prove where they went. And if you start taking everyone's, the amount that everybody is reporting and trying to make that equal 15%, it can be a very difficult thing to do. And so because employers are responsible for making sure their employees report tips, that puts them in a vulnerable position as well. So, with that, I will stand aside for any questions or comments.
Representative Croker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for this bill, and I just want to clarify a couple of things about this bill, because I think the tendency of the body is to want to debate the merits of the different tip-sharing pay plans, and that really has nothing to do with this bill. This bill is about the right of the employer to set a pay plan. As a small business owner, I have hired dozens and dozens of people, and every single person I hire, I go over what their pay plan is, and they can choose to come work for me on that pay plan or not come work for me on that pay plan. But I have the right as an employer to set the policy of what our pay plan is going to be, and the potential employees that I'm hiring have the choice to accept that pay plan and come work for me or go work for somewhere else. Restaurant owners should have that freedom. If you think it's a bad pay plan or a good pay plan, is irrelevant. What is relevant is the fact that they should have the right to set the pay plan and negotiate that with the potential employees, and those employees can choose to come work for them or can choose to go work for a different restaurant with a different pay plan. So please support this bill.
Representative Connolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On and against this bill, Even though it sounds like this bill makes sense in terms of efficiency and taking care of employers and all of the kind of problems that the good representative from Teton County outlined, this bill has, I think, a very serious unintended consequence. And if you look on page 2, Romanet I, there's a definition of who would be included. Food service establishment personnel directly serving customers, including wait staff. And we all understand wait staff are the ones who are receiving tips. But then it goes on to include bus staff, service bartenders, hosts, counter personnel who serve customers and chefs if they prepare food at tables. Right now, our statutes in 274202, which isn't in this bill, outline who gets minimum wage and who gets subminimum wage. Subminimum wage is $2.13 an hour. Okay, subminimum wage is what's paid to wait staff, and then they get tips. And of course, as the bill says, and of course we don't even need it because every worker needs to get federal minimum wage. But subminimum wage is allowed to those who are tipped employees. Okay? Tipped employees are defined in 274202 as, and I'm quoting from the statute, a tip employee is one who customarily and regularly receives more than $30 per month in tips. So all of a sudden, $30 a month, that's nothing, right? That's $8 a week. All of a sudden, we are now defining bus staff, service bartenders, hosts, and counter personnel as possibly tipped employees who will receive or could receive, if an employer wants to, subminimum wage at $2.13. I don't think we want to do that. So on and against the bill, and if we do pass it, I'll be bringing an amendment to change this element of our minimum wage statute.
Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good representative who just spoke before me was kind of saying what I was looking at on page 3, number 4, Romanet 4. This is the thing that has bothered me about this bill ever since we have been here talking about it. If you have a young girl working for somebody and they say, well, we're going to pay you $2.13 and you'll have to make it up in your wages or your tips, and they don't make it up, this young girl, to keep her job, doesn't really feel like she wants to go to the employer and say, I didn't make I didn't make minimum wage, and you're only paying me $2.13. So I think there's a real, with that section, that really is bothering me, that the young employers, the young girls that finally get their first job, are really hesitant to go to their boss and say, you're not making up the difference between my $2.13 and the federal minimum wage. Now, if you're talking somebody that works at a real nice restaurant and they're professional type waitresses, they are going to make a lot of money. They're going to make their, you know, they make way more in tips than they make in their wage. So that's a thing that the sponsor and I have talked about, and I'm very concerned about that. So I think that would be one of the main things that would want or make me want to vote against this bill. Thank you.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's interesting that a lot of the arguments we've heard against this bill are somehow that it disadvantages employees, which I think is as far from the truth as you can get. First, I mean, the bill says that they have to earn federal minimum wage before the tip pooling comes in. So in all deference to the prior speaker, I don't think you can vote on this against this bill because you think somebody's going to ignore the law. This bill requires that federal minimum wage be paid. But even more significant, we've heard some arguments that, well, let's just let them work it out among themselves. Let's let those waitresses go share on their own, and that'll take care of it. Let's keep, you know, the employer out of it. What that ends up doing is one of two things. Either they don't share, and so those involved directly in the service of the customer don't get to share in those tips, and they lose out on that benefit. Or number two, if the waitress or waiter is out sharing those tips, they get taxed on what they share. They get penalized for sharing. So if I make my tips and I decide to go share that 15%, I'm going to pay FICA and Social Security on all that. How fair is that to the wait staff? And yet the person that gets the shared tips doesn't have to pay any tax on it. Whereas if you have a system in place, like the other 47 states of the union do, and allow somebody to share their tips, you're taxed on what you actually receive. And to me, that's the essence of fairness. There's so many of us on this floor that have been waiters or waitresses at one point, including myself, and fortunately I was bad enough at it that I had to go look for other work. But that leads to this sort of false assumption that we know exactly how these things work. And the key is that there are a lot of people that have direct impact on service in a restaurant, and we should allow employers and managers to manage for that so that everybody can get the maximum benefit out of it.
Chairman Davison.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I stand on and against this bill. I think it says on page one that tips and gratuities are the sole property of the employee. Then when you go down here, it says that they will be required on page two, little numeral three, that they will be required to contribute to this pool, this tip pool. So I think we're contradicting ourselves, and I've worked waitress long enough that I know that you're lucky to get all of your tips. Whether it's a law or whether it's not a law, many, many times the boss is who tells you what to do or takes those tips for something else. And I think we're infringing on the rights of these people. Thank you.
Representative Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm on and against this bill also. When I go to a restaurant, I tip the waitress. She either did a good job or a bad job. It's going to reflect on her tip. If she wants to tip the busboy who helped her clean the table, that's her decision. She wants to tip the cook, that's her decision. They make $2.13 an hour. I decide who I give the tip to, let them decide who they give their portion of their tip to if they want to at all. Thank you.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For a point of clarification, just assuming that the bill may pass, particularly after watching the fastest fighter bomber that ever was made, the F-111 was in through previously. On page 2, section 3II, line 18, if you would take a look at that and make sure that you're putting in print what you actually may intend to have happen, I would suggest that you might consider a friendly amendment on line 21 that after the words gratuity, say received by that individual, so that you're not asking that person to take 15% of something that is very difficult to contemplate. So if that person has $100 in tips that evening, it's only $15 of what she or he has received. Thank you.
Chairman Zwanister.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I stand in support of this bill, but I do have a question for the sponsor. Does this bill allow for the employer that's distributing the tips to take a portion out? Thank you.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It does not allow the employer to take out any portion, and it specifically specifies who can get the tip, and there are a very limited number of people who can get the tip because it is a tip and gratuity. It's specified in federal law and in state law that it goes to the server or servers who receive the tip. Now, there were a couple of things, regarding the last question about changing it to the tips received from that for that person. There is a little bit of a question with that because, we heard from one speaker who said, well, when I leave a tip, I expect it to go to that one person. I don't think that, and I know a lot of other people who don't think that. When I go to a restaurant and I have a cocktail waitress and I have a waitress, I expect that there's a system for distributing those tips. I don't think I have to segregate that out. When I go to a bar and I watch a game for 4 hours and I have a drink server, but then I order lunch from a different server, I expect that they have a way of distributing those tips. And so who actually did receive the tip? It's,
The other, and there was another comment about whether or not waiters and waitresses would want some type of system of tip distribution. And I can tell you that the waiters and waitresses that I have spoken with are in favor of this because they don't know who came on at 4 o'clock to bus tables. They don't know who came on at 6 o'clock to bus tables. They don't want to have to keep track of that. It's much easier to make a 15%, you know, give 15% up, let somebody else keep track of the tips, let somebody else, and this doesn't require an employer to do this. An employer's going to, but the maximum that an employee would be giving up is 15%, and they wouldn't have to deal with it. They wouldn't be taxed on it. They wouldn't have to figure out who gets it, and there would be a uniform system that everybody participates in, that each waiter and waitress is giving a fair amount rather than it being left up to each person. With regard to minimum wage, although our statutes don't define who is customarily receives tips, the Department of Labor Field Operations Handbook does define who customarily receives tips. And they define that as being wait staff, bus staff, service bartenders, hosts, and counter personnel. And then they go on to add the chefs, which we deleted in the amendment. They go on to add, you know, people from other industries. But those specific people do not have to receive minimum wage. Those people are already defined by federal law as being customarily receiving tips. They do not have to be paid minimum wage today in the state, and they're not being paid minimum wage today in the state because in my experience, most cases, they're already getting the amount of tips voluntarily given to them that they are meeting the minimum wage. Now, with regard to a waiter or waitress having to go up to their boss and saying, I didn't make that amount, that's the responsibility of the employer to track the tips. You're supposed to ask your employees how much they made. They report that back to you. You have to pay employer wage taxes on that. You have to pay employee wage. You have to withhold employee wage taxes on that. And you already have to track that. That's my responsibility as an employer. And when I did have tipped employees, that was all part of my payroll module. I asked them every night how much they made in tips. That was all of my employees, I was a pizza delivery, so they were already making minimum wage, but I still had to track it. And then we would track how much they made as an average hourly wage, and that's all part of the point of sale systems that happen. And even if there aren't point of sale systems, it's still the responsibility of the employer to do that. And if they're not doing it, they're not following the law. And we can argue about, does this make it easier to not follow the law? I don't think it makes it easier to not follow the law. If you're not interested in following the law, you probably already have a tip policy to begin with. If you're taking tips from your employees, this does not make it easier to take tips from your employees.
Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can't help but think we're reading too much into this. We had testimony from businesses, and we had testimony from former waiters and waitresses, and the gist I got out of it, you know, I've never been a waitress but the gist I got was since 1957 the way of doing things in restaurants has changed, and I think you all know that you go into a restaurant, you have somebody bring you a cold beverage, or you might have somebody bring you water. A restaurant back in my hometown, they have a separate salad server, and that's their specialty. And I think, maybe the sponsor can straighten me out if I'm wrong here, but I think that we're one of three states that haven't really gotten with this post-1975 or 57 law. And again, I just don't think it's that big a dramatic change. It's what people are doing already anyway.
Representative Petroff.
If there are no more questions, I'd call for the question.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Madden's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with recommendation that House Bill 112 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 112 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, there are a lot of questions about House Bill 69. It is on the bottom of the list. It won't be heard until Wednesday, so it will just reside there on the bottom of the list. And I should have some more bills for you after lunch. With that, Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole beg leave to rise and sit again at 2:30.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed?
Aye.